Good evening. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow students, good evening. I am delighted to ask you all to come on in, take some seats. There are a lot of seats at the front. My name is Abe Fuchs. I'm a member of the Faculty of Medicine, and I have a real pleasure on behalf of members of the organizing committee, my colleagues and friends, Cappy Flanders, Ivy Schuster, in welcoming you all to this mini health sciences symposium. First, a little research. This is a university, so I'd like to get some data, if you won't mind. How many of you are CGEP students? Super. Are there any high school students in the room? Fantastic. Can you tell me by a show of hands, for how many of you is this your first visit to the McGill campus? Great, about a third of you. So a special welcome to you all for whom this is your first visit, your first formal visit, and it's really a treat to have you with us here. Some of you will know that we have for many years now been running a series called Mini-Med. And in fact, the website to send in questions is still called Mini-Med, but the series is not Mini-Med, it's Mini-Health Sciences. We'd like to demonstrate to you all that there are many, many wonderful pathways to become a caregiver in the healthcare system. In addition to physicians, there are nurses, dentists, physiotherapists, occupational therapists, social workers, speech pathologists, nutritionists, people who work in dietetics, kinesiologists, patient advocate programs. There's a huge array and many, many ways to help people as direct caregivers. And it's very clear that really good medical care, really good health care, also provides and requires prevention. It requires psychologists. It requires a whole array of people working in a team. And healthcare is developed to the point where single individuals working alone don't really provide healthcare anymore. It's a healthcare team. All of you, many of you are young enough to remember pediatricians, and they certainly work with nurses, sometimes other specialists. Sometimes you need investigations from a psychologist, a speech pathologist, whatever. That's the reason we have an array of tables up at the front, up on the sixth floor, where you can get information and meet students who work in all those disciplines. We want you to have a chance during these lectures to not only hear from faculty, but to meet students and find out what is nursing all about. What do occupational therapists do? How do social workers help? What is rehabilitation? And so we've chosen topics that introduce to you the full array of health care by all the people who provide it. We also demonstrate to you by showing you that of our seven lecturers, only three have medical degrees. The others have degrees that are relevant to health care, but not medicine as such, but health care nonetheless. So it's important to get that message and to understand our thinking in putting this series together for you. We also want to point out, for those of you who love data, and all students at your stage and later stages love information, that the website that we have set up will have available to you, in most cases, the PowerPoint that you're going to hear and see from our speakers, a biography of the speaker, in case you forget what I'll tell you, and some articles that person has chosen that you may like to do, not for homework, but for your own pleasure and reading. Maybe homework is pleasure too, although I'm not going to take a vote on that one. So, it's for us also a very special event because while we have for 14 years been hosting some students and mostly older folks, older people from the community, we designed this year's series just for you. for CGEP students, high school students. We want to reach out to you. We want you to be comfortable on the university campus. We want you to consider a career in the healthcare professions. And we want to connect with you and have you connect with us and, of course, with each other, because it'd be great to have you talk to each other before the lecture while having cookies and after the lecture to get to know each other as well and learn about people from different CGEP, from different communities, and from different interests in healthcare. You notice up here the Brain Project. It'll come back. That is two special lectures and tours of the Montreal Neurological Institute called the Brain Project. Those are available to you on October 23rd and 30th prior to the lecture that you'll be enjoying later that evening. But you have to sign up for those, and there's a sign-up desk in the back so you can learn more about that. After the lecture, and we're going to get to that very soon, we will have a question and answer session, but a little different from the usual one where you raise your hand. We'd like you to write your question down on one of the cards that you have. One of our volunteer students will pick up the cards, bring them downstairs, and we'll select the ones. Sometimes there's duplicates, and we can make the question and answer period more efficient in that way. And those of you who are watching from far away and live streaming can send in their questions, his or her, to our email system. And we have a student. Yeah, all the information escapes as soon as I say it, right? So this is the brain I talked to you about. These are the people helping us, the faculty, health sciences, McGill Office for Science and Society, sorry. There it is. If you want to ask a question, email the question to that email address, and it'll be received here, and we'll put you into the system for questions. So on to our very special lecture for tonight by a colleague and friend who's a member of the Faculty of Medicine, Dr. Amir Raz. Dr. Raz has a very wonderful career, and you can ask him questions about it after the lecture and maybe even personally if you come running down at 8 o'clock when we're finished. He came to us from Israel, where he was a fighter pilot in the Israeli Air Force. He then decided to train in psychology, which he did at Hebrew University. Trained in the United States, more training in Israel than worked in the U.S., and became a psychologist with a very special interest in the brain, how the brain works, and the kind of experiments we can do to figure out how we do what we do, how we understand what we understand. Along the way, however, he had another hobby. He became a magician. I don't know if you're showing any tricks tonight or just lectures. He might, if you ask him nicely. But his interest in magic, his interest in suggestibility and illusion, led to an interest in hypnosis, and you're going to hear about that tonight as well. So Dr. Raz is a member of and a professor in our departments of psychiatry, neurology, neurosurgery, and psychology. He works both at the Jewish General Hospital Lady Davis Institute, where he has one research group, and he has another research group working on University Avenue connected with the Neurological Institute. And you'll see why when he gives his talk, because he uses very specialized equipment to look at brain function as he's doing his experiments. So I think we're really going to enjoy those lectures. He has published lots and lots of papers. One interesting one on hypnosis is available on the website. It's very short. It's easy to read. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So when you go home, look up the website, read his article, and I'm sure if you have any questions about it after, you could send it to the same email address, and we'll send it over to Dr. Raz, and maybe he'll be able to answer your questions directly. So I'm really pleased that Dr. Raz is going to be our first speaker. He's going to lead us off. He's a very entertaining speaker, has given lectures literally all over the world, and we're very thrilled to have him with us tonight to start on the subject of the twilight zone of hypnosis. Amir.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I'm going to just make a quick transition from this thing into a different PowerPoint, which is mine. And as I do this, I will just mention to you, let me just find it. That's not it, but this should work. This is not it. It's the first one, but it's not coming up. I'm not sure why. Unless you put, oh, I see. You put one slide, okay. Thank you, that was confusing. Okay. All right, so I'd like to start by talking to you just a little bit about, I think Abe did a very nice job of sort of telling you a little bit about me, and he definitely hit all the right things. I was also a good swimmer. I was also playing the trumpet, but we're not going to get into that right now. The relevant thing for the lecture that I'm going to talk to you about today is this particular slide that I want you to sort of look at for a little bit. So you see, there's no question that today most people are interested in the brain, and they're relatively speaking, or generally speaking, there are two approaches to study the brain. One approach is fairly technical in the sense that it starts from cells and ionic channels and genetics and recombinant DNA and like things like that, and you work your way up. And that sort of approach is a bottom-up approach. You start with the very molecules and, you know, with the little things that you're dealing with at the cellular level, at the molecular level. This is the kind of approach that we often hear about in medical school and in other biochemical, you know, biochemistry and chemistry and things like that. Then there's a whole other approach that people often don't get to hear about, or they don't fully, are not fully exposed to it, that is as powerful, as rich, some people would argue richer, that actually comes all the way from the other side. It starts with the brain as a collective, with the higher brain functions, with our thought processes, with our expectations, with things that have to do with our culture, with things that have to do with the way that we're brought up. What are we thinking about certain things, and what do we expect certain things to be, and so on. And it turns out that these two approaches have very different philosophical underpinnings and actually very different results that come as a result. One is called bottom-up. It starts from the very little molecules that you're studying under a microscope, and you need very strong kind of instruments in order to see what's happening at the very tiny, minute level. And then you build up, going all the way up to the individual, to the organism. And the other one starts with the organism, or starts even with beyond the organism, with some kind of a metacognitive, like what's happening in the world, what's happening in the social system, what's happening in what the person is thinking, and then going all the way back down. That's called the top-down approach. The top-down approach, so if you go to the beach, you know, you usually choose what kind of beach you go to, if you go to the nudist beach or you go to a different kind of beach. And we are going to go to the top-down camp today, because the top-down camp, in general, is getting the short end of the stick, usually, when it comes to what people know. And that's because the bottom-up camp is very strongly represented in our culture, in our Western culture, at least, by various professions. The top-down, as interesting, as vast, again, probably vaster, I'll explain why in just a few minutes, has to do with other things. Now, in order to demonstrate, like if I tell you bottom up and top down, a lot of people say, you know, what is that? That sounds like a whole bunch of words. It's not quite clear to me. Okay, so I sort of anticipated that. So let me show you maybe a quick demonstration. Here's a person, a real person about your age, maybe a hair older, who I videotaped many years ago. You'll see that because you're going to see me in the video. You're going to see I'm going to have a lot more hair on my head. But without further ado, watch it and figure out what top-down is. This particular person, a healthy person, again, not only a healthy person, but a healthy person about your age coming to university, was hypnotized, whatever that means, not to remember the number 4. That's a very peculiar thing to do to a person. This is not done for entertainment. This is done for a scientific study. I want you to see.
How much is 1 plus 1?
What's happening?
2.
Right, that's not very hard. How much is 2 plus 1?
3.
3 plus 1.
What do you think the answer is going to be?
So, just show me again. Something got mixed up.
Let me show you again.
Do it again. Do it slowly and count out loud.
Let me show you again what happened here, okay? Something weird happened. I want you to watch it again. The disk basically skipped. It was unpaused for a moment.
Now, Sam, let me ask you, just for the record, okay, let me ask you a few very simple questions that you know how to answer very well. It's going to strike you as funny, maybe, but just let's go through the motions. How much is 1 plus 1?
2.
Right, that's not very hard. How much is 2 plus 1?
3.
3 plus 1?
5.
5 plus 1?
6.
Good. Now, can you just count your fingers for me? Just, you know, hold your fingers out and then point to them and count. I know it sounds a little weird, but just count your fingers for me.
Count my fingers?
Yeah, put them up like that and then just count your fingers.
Okay.
Count them out loud.
1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay, do it again and do it slowly for me, okay?
1.
No.
2.
Right.
3.
Right. Go ahead.
1, 2, 3.
Go on.
3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
How many fingers do you have?
10.
That's right. So just show me again. Something got mixed up.
Yeah.
Okay, just do it again. Do it slowly and count out loud. Maybe it'll help you if you say it louder.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
What's happening?
How
many fingers do you have in one hand? Let's go for just one hand. 5. So just count them for me. Just point to one, to the fingers of like one hand and just count them.
Do you get it? Weird. Really weird. This is almost what you get when you go to certain psychiatric departments or certain neurology wards. This is almost like taking a healthy person and turning him or her into a patient, but just a temporary patient, and actually there's nothing wrong with them. It's just a suggestion. Is it possible? Is it possible to take someone and to give them a suggestion or to influence them in a top-down fashion as opposed to a bottom-up fashion? Sure. Of course it is. This type of intervention, this top-down type of intervention, in this particular case, comes from an interaction between two people. I was one, and she was the other. And with a very particular dynamic that is created, a therapeutic dynamic, I was able to create something in her brain that actually prevented her temporarily from accessing the number 4, the representation of the number 4, the semantics of the number 4, the orthography of the number 4, how it's written, the sound of the number 4, the meaning of the number 4. The whole fourness has sort of dissolved in some kind of a weird way. What does that mean, really? Does it mean that we have some kind of a brain area that is responsible for 4? That sounds a little bit unlikely. We probably have a network. We probably have like some higher concept. But do you see what's happening here? Instead of going to the molecules, instead of dealing with the DNA, instead of doing something that has to do with titration and gels and pipettes in a wet lab, I actually went all the way around. And I started with the individual, and I went straight to higher brain function headquarters, and I told higher brain function headquarters that they don't know what the number 4 is. So it's actually the chief of staff who doesn't know the number 4, but all the people underneath know it quite well. The whole structure knows, but there's like something at the top that says that you're not supposed to know. It's a very peculiar kind of situation, and most people are completely unfamiliar with these kind of demonstrations. But these demonstrations are actually more common than you think. Not necessarily through hypnosis, through other things, but hypnosis is a very nice demonstration that people can relate to very quickly, and they can sort of understand as a model, using hypnosis as a model, as a lens, as a vehicle, if you want to think about it that way, how top-down effects work. Now, top-down effects are extremely important in therapeutic interactions. Top-down effects are also important in marketing, they're also important in other fields, but in therapeutic interactions, they are critical because they actually have a lot of influence on regulating physiology. Physiology is not just regulated in a bottom-up fashion, it's also regulated in a top-down fashion, and sometimes, more often than you think, the top-down regulation actually overrides the bottom-up regulation. I'll try to demonstrate these to you in different ways. We have more clips to watch, but I think you're beginning to get the idea. If you really insist, I'll show how I looked 15 years ago. It comes up in a few seconds. But before we do that, that's always intriguing, even to me. Every time I look, I say, who is that handsome guy? And, you know, and so, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, something else. There are other ways that we can influence people in a top-down fashion. Let's go through them a little bit, okay? So, for example, most people are a little bit confused about top-down effects. Let's take them and talk about them a little bit before we sort of bring hypnosis into the picture, okay? So, let's say you're about to take a pill, okay, or a drug. Most people really pay attention to the drug or to the pill, and they don't really pay attention to the whole psychology and the whole ritual that goes around taking a pill. Who gave you the pill? How much did it cost? How much did you have to work in order to get it? Did you have to wait for 5 hours? Did you have to travel to Switzerland to get it? Did it cost you $500 a pill or 5 cents? Is it covered by insurance? Is it not covered by... These things make a big difference to people, and most people are sort of confused about these things, and they don't quite know how to factor that into the picture. So there are all kinds of non-drug effects that are going on. What are non-drug effects? You know, the color of the pill, the color of the pill, the size of the pill, as I said, you know, how much it costs and stuff like that. Who are the people who are really knowledgeable about these things? Well, usually these are the behavioral scientists. These are the people who study behavior. They study psychology. They study sociology. They study anthropology. They study the social science that actually accompanies and sets the context and is the infrastructure in which often therapy or medical intervention is set. Because these things have a context to them and so on. Now, what most people don't understand is that often just getting treatment is enough in order to get certain physiological processes going, and that's not done necessarily in a bottom-up fashion. Sometimes it's done in a top-down fashion. I'll try to demonstrate these to you, showing you a few studies. Before I show you the studies, some of these studies are quite clever, and some of them are really cool, but I want to sort of show you, you know, what's going on in the world these days. So as you know, here's a really fancy way of, you know, having a screensaver, for example. So you come to my lab, you know, I scan you, and I can, you know, give you your brain, and we can do like a whole striptease show with your brain, you know, and you can sort of, you know, see all the elements in the brain and stuff like that. Something like this, okay, like an animation like this, used to be extremely difficult to do 20 years ago. As a matter of fact, it was like the cutting edge of technology, and people had to, you know, pay a lot of money to make this happen. Let me just play it again because it's so good. And people used to, you know, they needed, you know, supercomputers in order to perform these things and all the calculations. And by the way, all the color codes here, they're actually meaningful. We can maybe talk about that towards the end. But the fact of the matter is that this is a pleasure to look at just because of the graphics and so on, and especially you guys from the generation. You know, you text message to the person right next to you. You know, you text message, you know, to them because it's easier from whispering or leaning over and then talking to them. It's the same thing. Today we can do these things really, really easily. The people who are doing these things today are you. You. It doesn't need to be me. You don't need to have like a PhD in computational neuroscience to do these things. You can do it. We have software packages that allow you to do these things, and what was very difficult to do 20 years ago is a snap to do today. We don't need supercomputers. You can do it on your laptop. You can do it on your Macintosh. You can do it on your iPhone. Crazy world. But the question stays the same. What questions does it answer? Other than the pretty graphics, what does it tell me? What can it tell me? Let me show you a few things that these kind of techniques can tell us, because this is a real revolution. There's a real revolution here. Neuroimaging, or looking inside non-invasively what's happening inside the brain, is a real revolution. And one, and it's also, it's a revolution that also has some caveats, which we're not going to talk about today. It's not perfect. It's not a perfect revolution. Not everything that you see you should immediately believe and embrace. But it's very interesting because it tells you quite a bit about what's happening in the brain without having to open it up. Let me describe to you a study that is very old, and I intentionally take old studies to show you that this has been going on for a while, by two Canadian scientists. It's important for me to emphasize that they're Canadian because we are in Canada, and also they're very, very good, and they're at the top of their game. And when it comes to top-down and specific issues of top-down, control and top-down approaches to health, Canada really has a very nice collection of top people in the field. So there is, you know, there's something to be proud of about being Canadian, and one of the things to think about is the fact that I, as a non-Canadian, came to McGill to Canada to, you know, work here because, among other things, of the critical mass of people who are doing these kind of work, and this is very important. This is very important to recognize that there's an international strength there of these kind of things. Here's a study that I'm going to sort of walk you through. This is a PET study. PET stands for positron emission tomography. I don't expect you to know, you know, what it is, but it's a form of imaging technology, very fancy, that has to do with the radioactive ligands and stuff like that. So it's not entirely non-invasive, but it's pretty good. And it's done very quietly. It was very common in the late 1990s. It was the sort of, you know, apex of technology back then. And one of the things to notice here is these four columns I'm going to describe. I'm going to walk you through these four columns and what it means. PET scans, and this is what you see here is a PET scan. PET scans are quiet. They're mute. There's absolutely no sound. Not even like a little whimper. Nothing. It's completely, the room is completely quiet, and there's no thumping, there's no crackles, nothing at all. This was very important because this is an auditory study. What did the researchers do? Now listen very carefully. What they did was really clever and unusual. They basically created four conditions. In condition number one, they took people, this is what you see here in the first column in gray. They took people and they put them inside a PET scanner and they basically told them, just lie there and do nothing. Just relax and let your brain wander and just, you know, spontaneously lie there and do nothing. So this is, we call this the baseline, and you can see like baseline activity in this first column, and it's not quite clear what we're measuring, but we're measuring something, some spontaneous activity that's going on. Here, the red column, the second one here, is a situation where the people are lying down in the scanner. In this particular scanner, you lie down supine on your back. So people are lying down on their back, and they're listening to the voice of the experimenter. The experimenter is actually saying something to them. In this particular case, it was a recording. So the experimenter pressed play on a particular recording device or in a playback, and they would hear some kind of a recording. All the patients, all the subjects, in this particular case, it's a study, so it's all the participants, heard exactly the same thing. Now comes the interesting part. This particular condition, this third column, shows you the brain activation of what was going on in the participant's brain when they were lying in there. There was absolutely no sound going on, and they were asked to imagine the voice that they heard before. So they're lying in there exactly like in the baseline condition, only now we're asking them to imagine, to pretend that, you know, they are hearing the recording that they heard before. So they're trying very hard to create in their brain, in their mind, they're trying to create that voice and to pretend that they're listening to that recording that they just heard a few seconds or a few minutes ago. Okay, you understand that condition. And then the last condition, lo and behold, is a situation when we take them, we hypnotize them. We don't know what that is yet, but we hypnotize them. And after we hypnotize them, we tell them, now we're going to put the recording on and you'll be able to hear it, but we actually don't. So they're there, they're hypnotized, and they're thinking that the recording is going on under hypnosis, and they're actually hearing something that doesn't exist. So they're basically hearing, they're hallucinating the recording. Okay? They're hallucinating the recording. Now, these people that are inside the magnet, they're not regular people. They're highly hypnotizable people, and we're going to talk about that in just 2 minutes. Who is highly hypnotizable? How do you determine if somebody is highly hypnotizable? Should I be highly hypnotizable? Is it good to be highly hypnotizable? How much money do I get if I'm highly hypnotizable? These are good, you know, interesting questions. So the first thing to notice, though, the first thing to notice is something very important. Did you notice that this column here and this column here are sort of similar? Did you notice that the activation when you hear something veridically, truthfully, genuinely, there's something to be heard and you're listening to it? And when there's nothing to be heard, but you are thinking that something is playing and you're listening to it, these are very, very similar activations in terms of the brain. So in terms of the brain, actual areas are triggered inside, and we can see exactly where they are. But even in the absence of sound, we create, or the brain can create, in highly hypnotizable people, it can create this sound as if it's actually coming from the outside, even in the absence of an external stimulus. That's pretty weird. Because that suggests to me, and maybe also to you, that something very dramatic is happening here. And it is. And this is a top-down effect. Why is it a top-down effect? Why am I insisting that this is a top-down effect? Why do I keep on saying top-down, top-down all the time? Because there's nothing bottom-up here. There's no stimulus. Nothing is actually playing. Nothing is hitting, nothing is like vibrating the air molecules. Nothing is hitting, you know, the auditory organs that are supposed to detect sound. It's quiet. It's actually happening from headquarters. Because headquarters is expecting the sound, it's creating the sound. And you have a whole, it's not just creating the sound, it's creating like a whole story of what is being said, and like a whole analogy and a whole narrative and the whole thing. Later, you can actually interview these people and say, what did they say? And they can tell you exactly what the recording said, although there was no recording. So it's a very interesting kind of concept. They are listening to something that they are generating internally. When do we experience these things? Well, we experience these things on a regular basis. Every time we go to sleep, for example, and we dream, right? When we dream, we have dreams, and we are generating these dreams. They're not actually happening in the world. They're happening inside our heads. So in many ways, this is almost like a dream kind of experience. When else does it happen? For example, sometimes we daydream. Daydream has nothing to do with sleep, as you know. Your eyes are open, you're looking, but you're not entirely registering all the information that is happening. You are sort of more attuned to internal information. You're actually feeding on internal information. Your attentional system is turned inwards. Your attentional system is turned inwards. Usually your attention system is turned outwards, but in this particular case, it's turned inwards. And that's the first thing you should know about hypnosis. Hypnosis is an attentional manipulation. And attention is something that we know quite a bit about. Because you see, when I say hypnosis to you, and it doesn't matter who you are, if you are even a very, very highly educated person, a professor at a university, unless you really know about hypnosis, what you usually know about hypnosis is folklore. Woody Allen movies, stage hypnosis, magicians, performers, clucking like a chicken, all kinds of weird things like that. But hypnosis really has nothing to do with all these things. These are just all kinds of exploitations of hypnosis by Hollywood, by a performer who's there to entertain and humiliate other people at your, you know, for your entertainment pleasure. But in general, hypnosis is a very dramatic, strong, potentially therapeutic procedure that you can use in order to influence the physiology, including the brain physiology, of other people. And you can do it non-invasively, and it doesn't require surgery, and it's cheap, and if it's done properly, there's very little risk. So you're beginning to understand, even as you listen to me here speaking glibly about these things, you're beginning to understand that there's some potential here if it's harnessed, if it's leveraged in a judicious way, in an ethical way, if it's done by professionals who are regulated and so on, there is some potential here, and you're right. And hypnosis, which has been sort of something that has really suffered from a checkered history and has been largely shunned even by the scientific community, is making a huge comeback into science, into health science. It has been making this comeback over many years as a result of more and more research that shows the powerful effects of top-down interventions in the health sciences. Now, when I sort of give you this particular example, I can give you many, 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 but I only have like a few minutes to talk to you, so I just want to give you a few more flavors. Let's fast forward a few years from 1998 to 2004. So 2004, most of you not only were born already, but you were reading some scientifically minded material, I think. And, or at least some of you. And what you see here, maybe you also read this already, you know. What you see here is a paper, and this particular technique is a different kind of technique. This is not a PET study, a positron emission tomography study. This is an fMRI study. fMRI today is so common, you basically have it at just about every large university. Here at McGill, we have several scanners of that nature. These scanners cost millions and millions of dollars, but they have become so ubiquitous, and these scans have become so ubiquitous that just about any person in my lab, for example, and I have a lab of really like about 24 people, and it's just about every person or every other person in my lab has already done, you know, a scan or a study that involved some form of neuroimaging because it is so ubiquitous. These things 10 years ago, 15 years ago, were prohibitively expensive. And the technology was so, you know, difficult to get your head around that it was just, you know, only very few technical people could do it. Today, just about anyone can do it with the right training and with the right grooming. And that's really beautiful because the questions that you can answer are mind-altering and they're world-shattering. I mean, you can literally do things that would completely shock the world. For example, look at this. Here is a study that was done, by the way, by a very young guy, out of England. And he basically did a similar study to what our two Canadian friends did, but only in the domain of pain using a different mechanism. It basically shows the same thing. Let me walk you through it. The top part is the brain of many, many, many individuals who've been averaged together under the suggestion, in this particular case, hypnotic suggestion. You can also do it without hypnosis. I'll talk about that towards the end. Hypnotic suggestion to basically suggest to them that they're experiencing a particular form of pain. Pain that was introduced to the arm, to the left arm, with a particular form of device, which we're not going to get into right now. It's not relevant to this talk. But in this particular slide, what you see is imagined pain, pain that is basically imposed on them with a suggestion that they're actually experiencing it. And these red spots that you see here are areas of the brain that have been hyperactive as a result of this suggestion. Okay, the middle slide or the middle brain slides basically show you what kind of activation you get when you actually impose the pain. And the stronger the color, the more you know, vibrant the color, the more painful the sensation is and the more active the signal is from the brain. So you can see that the pain that they felt was actually quite moderate compared to the pain that they felt when they were under the impression that it's happening to them. Can you see that? They were feeling more pain in this particular case when there was no pain to be felt than here when there was the pain. And you can see that it's very similar areas that are lighting up. And here, they are just trying to imagine this. Now, a lot of people are confused about what it means. Like if I tell you, you know, what does it mean I'm supposed to imagine that I have pain here? Let's say that I tell you, you know, I want you to imagine the taste of a banana. Hey, we've all had a banana at some point. Okay, even the people who don't like bananas, they've had a banana at some point because they needed to have a banana in order to know that they don't like it. So you know, we've all had bananas, or most of us have, unless you have a principal objection to bananas. And if you had a banana before, then you can theoretically imagine what it tastes like, right? But if I told you now, I really want you to imagine a banana in your mouth, or it could be also an orange, or it could be something else that you feel more comfortable with in terms of taste, in terms of shape, in terms of texture, in terms of your cultural background, in terms of who you are, at the end of the day, you're getting these kind of maps. It's much more difficult to imagine something than to have somebody else tell you that it's actually happening to you. Think about it this way. Let's assume that I'm in a lab and I am training someone to basically lift their arm time and again, lift their arm time and again, lift their arm time and again. And after doing it for 200 times, 300 times, 400 times, 500 times, they can actually do it almost in like perfect orchestration. And I put a lot of electrodes on their arms, and I can exactly measure the acceleration and how much force they're putting and all these things. Now, what I'm doing is I'm hypnotizing these people, and I'm telling them under hypnosis, there's actually a helium balloon attached to your wrist. And the helium balloon is actually lifting your arm, and it's lifting your arm exactly like you moved your arm before. So now, these people are lifting their arm, but they're under the impression that they're not lifting their arm. They're under the impression that a helium balloon is lifting their arm. And we can verify with all the electrodes that we have here that the movement and the acceleration and the force and the torque and all these physical parameters are exactly the same. So an observer who's looking from the outside, a third party looking from the outside, cannot tell if they're doing this because they are the authors and they're doing this voluntarily, volitionally, out of their own will, or this is happening to them because of a helium balloon that is connected to them and they're under the hypnotic suggestion that this is actually happening to them. So how can we tell? You see, an observer cannot tell. To an observer, it looks exactly the same. The two movements look exactly the same. To somebody who does the physiology, in terms of the muscles, in terms of the accelerations, it looks exactly the same. But to the brain scientist, to somebody like me, I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. I'm sort of a hybrid between a cognitive psychologist, a cognitive scientist, and a neuroscientist, a brain scientist. I'm sort of an amalgamation of these two professionals. To me, I actually look at what's happening between the ears, and I have a whole world there, and I can see what is happening in the brain when you're performing this particular movement, when you are the author of this movement, when you are actually doing it because you want to, or because you're under the impression that this is actually happening to you. Of course, in both cases, you are the author, right? You understand this. But the person under hypnosis momentarily, fleetingly, temporarily, is under the impression, the altered consciousness impression, that actually this is happening to them. It's like the difference between falling down or being pushed down. You know, if you're falling down, it's one thing. If you're being pushed down, you didn't do it. It's sort of happening to you. So there is something very interesting there that we can actually find with these kind of images, the kind of questions that we can ask, the kind of paradigms that we can use are almost at the forefront of philosophy. This is no longer just about, you know, therapy. This is not just about helping people. This is like we are beginning to unravel, to unlock the human mind. We're beginning to sort of think about, hey, what does it mean to want something? What does it mean to have free will? What does it mean to do something because you wanted to, as opposed to when something is happening to you that you didn't want? These are very interesting questions, and some of these questions have a lot of real implications. You know what, before we go into this more, and I see the time is ticking, that's the nature of time, I want to show you a few more things before I come into the picture, just so that you can see how difficult it is for this particular young woman to come to grasp with what's going on. She's not an actress. She's actually doing this. She is exactly as if I took somebody here from this crowd. About 10 to 15% of the people who are sitting right now in this hall are going to be like this young woman. 10 to 15% of young adults fall into this category of being highly hypnotizable. What does it mean to be highly hypnotizable? Let's talk about that next.
Tell me one at a time.
One, two, three, five.
What about that one right there?
Okay, so again, my CD is skipping, and you know I'm gonna snap out of it just in the interest of time. So now the question is, now after you've seen this, the question is, what does it mean to be highly hypnotizable? Is it good or is it bad? This is a very complicated question because it's a charged question. It's charged because it's shrouded in myth. I'll give you an example. Let's say that I asked you, is it good or is it bad to have a high IQ score? I think most people would agree, hey, I don't care who you are. I think it's good to have a high IQ score rather than a low one. And if I ask you, but what does it mean to have a high IQ score? Well, I don't really know, but I think it's good to have a high one. And to be honest with you, that's the state of affairs right now. Nobody really knows what it means exactly to have a high IQ score, and there's a lot of debate scientifically and among psychologists and so on, educators, what does it mean to have a high IQ score? But when it comes to be highly hypnotizable, if I asked you, would you like to be highly hypnotizable or would you like to be low hypnotizable? I think that most people are confused about that question. On the one hand, they're intrigued because they see these kind of videos, and I have a whole, 500 hours that I can give you to watch. And then they say, but do I want to be one of these people? Does it mean that I'm feeble-minded? Does it mean that I can be easily manipulated? Does it mean that I am very unintelligent? Does it mean that I am likely to be sold certain things by salespeople and so on? The answer is no, but there's a reason why people are thinking these things. They're thinking these things because in our culture, there's a certain weight, there's a certain dogma, and there's a certain air of folklore that is associated with being highly hypnotizable. And this is not going back just to Woody Allen movies. It's going back from, before I was born, before Abe was born, and before other people were born. It goes back to times when people were hypnotized in France and in other locations around Europe, and they were mostly women, and they were considered to be hysterical women. And all kinds of demonstrations were made, and people who were hypnotizable were thought to be hysterical patients, and they were thought to have like psychiatric conditions and so on. And part of that theme, part of those sort of early days of hypnosis or of Western hypnosis, as we talk about it today, although we have demonstrated in scientific papers time and again, that it's all garbage, that it has nothing to do with what's going on, still to this day, people don't know. They don't know this stuff. They don't read the papers. They're not familiar with what's going on. And they're afraid. People still know more about hypnosis from movies like The Manchurian Candidate and from, all kinds of things that they see on, Hollywood or on the web with all these magicians, And they learn more about that than from science. When I started out, my introduction to hypnosis was through the magic world. I was a performing magician, and I saw how magicians that I used to work with and used to do all kinds of tricks that I knew very well how to do started to get into hypnosis shows. They would go into a room much bigger than this one with thousands of people in it, and they would hypnotize people. And as a young person, I was about your age, I would go up to them after and I would say, how did you do it? How does it work? What's going on here? And they would say to me, because I was a magician and they would, I was part of the clique, and I have no idea. You just take this book and memorize this script, and when you perform and when you say these things, people just fall down like flies. And I was fascinated by this kind of approach where people have no idea what they're doing. They just have a script that they're following. And somehow that script, that kind of performance, that kind of show is affecting 10, 15, sometimes more percent of the people. That was a fascinating concept for me. And very quickly, I started asking questions that magicians don't ask. For example, did you try doing it this way? Did you try doing it this way? Did you try it here? Did you try it there? Why do you think this is working? Why do you think this is not working? And at some point, the magicians really got very annoyed with me. And they said, hey, kid, are you here to help us or to hurt us? It's not helping, all these questions. You're distracting me. I don't know the answer. It's annoying and so on. And slowly I started veering off. And I still had my sort of, magician kind of performance act and things that I could do. But slowly I got very interested in how is it possible to make all these things happen? And one of the interesting things here is that a performance really is a top-down effect. A performance is a top-down effect, including this one. This is also a performance. In this particular case, I'm performing by talking to you in a lecture, and there are all kinds of rules that go, with that, what I'm supposed to do. But, if I would, jump on the table, take my clothes off, that's, it's possible, but most people don't do that in a lecture. They do that in other clubs and, other times. Not too far away from here, by the way. But the more important thing is that, we have certain expectations. We have certain expectations from what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and so on. It's very interesting to see, and observe that it's possible with performance, with ritual, with things that have to do with a top-down effect, it's possible to influence some extremely focal areas in the human brain. In a study that I did in 2005, I demonstrated, for example, that it's possible to influence this particular region that is highlighted here as sort of the blue crosshair here, this particular region that brain scientists called the anterior cingulate cortex. If you went to Google and you put in anterior cingulate cortex, which is a fancy word for a particular geographical part, you know, in the brain, you would learn that this particular area of the brain is responsible for conflict resolution, for monitoring, you know, when things are out of sync, when somebody says something that is not right, when you're trying to inhibit yourself. You know, often it happens to us, somebody comes to us and says something that is really offensive. I mean, they say something about your hairdo. Take me, for example, you know. So somebody says, oh, you know, I have better hairdo than you are. Let's say that I get really upset about that. I usually don't. But let's say that, you know, somebody gets really upset about that, and I feel like punching this person, you know, in the nose. But there's something in me that says, you know, you shouldn't do that. That's not nice. You know, this is not something that we do. Well, this area in the brain, the anterior cingulate cortex that I'm going to refer to as ACC for short, this particular area in the brain is an area that performs this computation. It performs this computation and tells you whether you should get angry and actually, you know, perform, or you should get angry but control it and contain it. It's not worth it. It's not worth, like, showing it. And we all have problems with this area. We all have problems with this area, some people more than others. And if you have a problem controlling these kind of impulsive kind of bouts of decision-making, often you behave in a way that is out of sync with what is expected from you, or what does society expect, or what a particular situation dictates. And it so happens that some people have, even completely healthy, normal people who have typical behavior, you know, on occasion, for example, when they're very sleep deprived, for example, when they're very hungry, for example, when they're extremely, extremely anxious, it's possible that they lose control over this area, and this area does not perform in its optimal way, and as a result, sometimes they slip, and some impulsive, you know, behavior comes out. You can see it particularly in children, less so in adults, and also we're less forgiving when we see it in adults. But with children, we see it all the time. You know, go to the IGA, you know, go to the metro, go next to the candy aisles, and you'll see a lot of kids, you know, the mother says, no, you can't do that. And sometimes, because the kids scream so much, the mother gets it. Because they just can't take the humiliation of other people looking, you know. And all. So, basically, the ACC of the children is not very evolved. It's not very developed, and we sort of recognize that. But with, you know, have you seen an adult go in the adult section and sort of throw this fit, you know? We usually wouldn't be as forgiving towards that kind of, or at least, you know, it's going to elicit some emotions, you know, from us. Turns out that it's possible with top-down control, it's possible to really have a major effect on this area. This has been documented time and again, not just in studies that I performed, but in studies that many other people over the world performed, which is one of the key features of the scientific method, right? The scientific method is not about one study or two studies. It's about a series of independent studies that sort of can replicate one another, and they can be done in Japan and in Yemen and in Israel and in Egypt and in any other country. When you perform this particular study, you actually get the same result. It gives us confidence that this is not a fluke. It gives us confidence that this is actually happening. This is actually the real deal. So we've been able to demonstrate that it's possible to influence extremely focal influence on highly millimetric areas of the brain, something that even a very skilled neurosurgeon cannot do. Why not? Because they change from person to person. The ACC in my brain is going to be in a slightly different location from the ACC in another person's, because it's not just an anatomical region, it's also a functional region. It's a functional region. It's not just, it's not made out of muscles. It's made out of tissue. And the tissue changes. It changes because the brain is soft tissue that sort of, you know, things migrate from side to side. It's not like, you know, dealing with your hands or with, you know, with the orthopedics of surgery in the body or in muscles and bones. Now, the reason that this is important to understand also is because the brain is extremely plastic. So some of the questions that were asked, as you can see, and I'm waiting for your signal, Abe, okay, so
30 seconds,
okay. So one of the things that I wanted to leave you with as we sort of talk about these things is that a lot of people ask me when they listen to this lecture and many other lectures like it, they say, well, what's the definition of hypnosis? And I often tell them, you know, in some fields, the definition is very tricky. Let me show you why. Here is a definition of hypnosis that you would get in a scholarly magazine. This is a definition of hypnosis that comes from John Kilstrom, one of the foremost scholars of hypnosis in this century. And he talks about hypnosis. He can give you a definition. I can read it to you. You can read it for yourself. But I just want to show you how this definition is actually not very helpful, because I can make a very small substitution. Notice, no offense to John Kilstrom, who's a friend of mine. Okay, notice what happens. I take hypnosis and I change it to something else. Courtship. Exactly the same text. Okay, but I just changed one word. Instead of hypnotist, I wrote here suitor. And the rest of the words are exactly the same. And you can see that it still works. So you see, hypnosis, it's very difficult to capture that because hypnosis is about a relationship. It's about a relationship. And what we're able to do with top-down effects, we're beginning to understand social relationships. We're beginning to understand how our relationship with the world, with other people, with ourselves, actually shapes our physiology. We're beginning to understand how meditation changes the way that our body feels and operates. We're beginning to understand that self-regulation can actually be achieved not just by taking drugs, but also by doing certain mental exercises. This is a fairly new realization that is being more and more supported by science, recent science, that is coming largely from the allied health sciences. Not necessarily from the bottom-up approaches, but from the top-down. I hope that this has been interesting for you. I'm going to, you know, stick around to answer questions, and I'm going to be around if you want to see a trick or two after. Thank you very much.
Okay, Amir, thank you. That's a wonderful overview. And now you understand why there were two titles to the lecture. One of them was The Twilight Zone. The other one is It's All in Your Head, not only the brain, but how it functions. So if we could get some lights up in the hall so that the people, so you have a chance to write down your questions on your cards, and those who collect the cards, these are McGill students wearing red McGill T-shirts. So hand your card to one of these nice young men or women. They'll bring it down here and we will launch the question period. So those of you who are watching from afar, send in your questions by email. So please write them down. You can discuss them with your friends quietly. All questions are good questions. So, bring them down, and we're going to start. Okay.
All right.
Once we start with questions and answers, you're going to have to write quietly so your neighbors can listen. Okay? There is a card over there. Pick a card, we're going to get to that later. Pick a card, any card. Okay. Dr. Oz, one young person wants to know, what are the characteristics of a person who is highly hypnotizable?
So that's a trick question. It's a trick question because for many years, we thought that the characteristics of a person who's highly hypnotizable, A, is that they're female, B, is that they're not very bright, and C, that they watch Star Trek and, you know, do, you know, things like that, and they have imaginary friends. And we've learned over the years that this is not at all the case. We've learned that you can be male or female. It makes no sense. We learned that you can be really extremely bright or not so bright at all. We learned that it has nothing to do with Star Trek or what you watch, but it has to do with your ability to dissociate. I'm sure that you're all familiar with those people, and it might even be you, those people who, when they watch a movie, they sort of, the phone can ring and they don't, you know, they can't hear it. Or their name is being called out and they, you know, they sort of miss it. You know, hey Robbie, you know, and they just miss it. So these are the people who can dissociate like that. People who, when they read a book, lose completely track of time. So they read a book and, you know, they close the book and it's been like 4 hours. You know, and they miss lunch and the whole thing. Some of us are like that. These are the people who, generally speaking, can dissociate. They can get so engrossed in a particular experience, almost to the exclusion of other things that are going on, be it their name being called out, environmental noise, being peckish and hungry for lunch, or many other things that are going on. So these are usually the people, these are the telltale signs, sort of speak, of people who are highly hypnotizable. Having said all that, I can tell you that there's a very structured way of finding out who is hypnotizable. One is a particular kind of structured questionnaire that we administer to a large group, such as the one that is sitting here. I often do it in my classes. This is called the Harvard Hypnotic Susceptibility Scale. You're not going to believe this, but it comes out of Harvard University. And there's another one that is called the Stanford, I'll let you guess where that comes from, Stanford Hypnotic Susceptibility Scale, which is done one-on-one and takes about 90 minutes to administer. And usually the way that we determine if somebody's really highly hypnotizable is by doing both. The Harvard in a group setting and then the Stanford in a private setting, and that usually gives us a very good impression of who's highly hypnotizable. And being highly hypnotizable is such a gift, as you're beginning to understand, because you can do all kinds of weird things that other people can only dream of doing, such as, you know, anesthetizing yourself or imagining certain things and just like many other things in life. If you harness it and if you learn how to use it appropriately, leverage it to your advantage, you can get very far.
Okay. A lot of people are very interested in hypnosis. So one, they want to know, how do you reverse it? I mean, this young woman forgot the number 4, and that can be a problem. So what do you do?
So when we perform hypnosis, any kind of hypnosis, at a university setting with somebody who's a professor or somebody who's like well-trained and well-versed in the field, we are bound to, at the end of the session, bring the person back to the same condition that they were in, or better. Okay? We cannot take somebody and send them to the world not knowing the number 4, or 3, or 2. So whatever we do, we have to, at the end, undo the procedure. And the whole trick here, and this is a real trick, the whole trick is to have somebody who does these things judiciously and ethically. When I say judiciously, I mean somebody who really knows when you don't go any further, because that could actually end up being, you know, creating some kind of abnormal reaction, an abreaction, and for that you have to learn quite a bit about hypnosis. There's training that goes with it. It's a clinical skill. It really is a clinical skill, just like you don't mess with surgery. And the other thing is ethically. So you have to do it judiciously and ethically. And when we say ethically, we mean to do it in a way that would not compromise in any way, any kind of moral or, you know, higher order kind of standards that we have about, you know, the privileges and the autonomy of the other person and the interaction.
So there are several questions about hypnosis in a different perspective when, you know, usually you make someone forget. So the question is, A, can you make someone learn something? B, can you help any of these students studying for exams? Not a bad thing. And C, Can you use it therapeutically? Can you help patients? Can you deal with people with trauma and questions of that
Good.
Kind?
So these are all excellent questions, and let's take them one by one. Can you take someone and tell them under hypnosis that they're a concert pianist, and as a result they'll come up to the piano and play, you know, a perfect Mozart sonata without having ever touched the piano? No, you can't. Can you take somebody and tell them that they're an Olympic athlete and as a result they're going to perform Olympically? No, you can't. Can you take someone who is a very good athlete and make them a hair better? Yes, you can. And that's why on the U.S. Olympic team and on many Olympic teams, I'm not sure about the Canadian, I have to look into this, but on the U.S. Olympic team for sure, because I was in discussions with them for many years, there's actually a hypnotist, because there's some kind of a relationship, it's a very complex relationship between mental performance and mental concentration and actual physical performance. So you cannot do things that you would not normally do, but you can actually improve, sometimes very modestly, but you know, when you are at the top of your game, even a modest improvement can actually make the difference between a gold medal and a silver medal. Sometimes it's a millisecond that would make the difference, sometimes less. So it's very important to understand that you cannot take somebody who doesn't know any Chinese and tell them under hypnosis that they speak Chinese, and as a result they speak Chinese. That's extremely unlikely. It's as unlikely as if you tell somebody under hypnosis that they have a third arm, and you know, and suddenly they grow another one. It just doesn't work that, you know, that way. But at the same time, there is some stuff that you can do, so you can bolster confidence, you can reduce anxiety, and all kinds of things that would actually result in improved performance. Hence, the second part of the question, can it be used therapeutically? Of course, that's the whole point. It could be used therapeutically, it could be harnessed to help people, just as, caveat, 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 it could be used destructively. So in the wrong hands, a hypnotist can squash someone and can make someone, can you know, ridicule someone and can create a lot of social scars. So just with other kind of professionals, it's very important to choose your people very carefully. And with hypnosis, it's particularly tricky because in Canada, it's unregulated. So, you know, there's no regulation of who is a clinical hypnotist in Canada, whereas in other countries, for example, in certain states in the United States, there is. So it's a little bit of a tricky issue, but when you are inside a university, you're usually in good hands, because the university regulates these things with an ethics protocol and so on.
Can you be sure that the effect is temporary? In other words, have there been reports of a long-term effect of hypnosis, and can someone forget the number forever?
I mean, To say that the effect is temporary, I need to sort of qualify that a little bit and quantify that a little bit, just so that you understand. As I mentioned to you before, hypnosis really is a bad term. It's a misnomer. It's not a good word to use for the process. The better word to use is attentive receptive concentration or something like that. It's a form of attention. Can you be in a situation where you're paying attention, you're stuck paying attention? Is it possible for you to, like, oh, I can't, you know, I'm paying attention since 8 o'clock in the morning, I can't release. You know, it's very unusual. Yes, it can happen. Yes, it can happen. It's extremely unusual. And that's why we say that most hypnotic effects are temporary, in the sense that, you know, you're very focused, and that's when you get the suggestion, and then you sort of, you know, release. The suggestion can linger. The suggestion can linger. So the effect of the hypnotic suggestion can linger, but the hypnosis itself, like the state, or if you want, the plane of concentration, or the experience, the hypnotic experience, usually comes and goes. If you're very religious, think about it this way. It's almost like prayer. You know, you can get into prayer, and you pray, and for a short period of time, you're in the zone, and then you're sort of back into your common wakefulness. Dreaming is the same thing. Daydreaming is the same thing, and so on. So it's sort of a situation when you're sort of drifting into a different mode, and then you're coming back. When you are in that different mode, you're thinking about the world differently, you might accept certain things differently, and those thoughts and those ideas and those suggestions that you got can actually follow you into your regular common wakefulness. And if that's done in a therapeutic way, hopefully that would make you into a healthier, happier person. That's the idea.
So is it connected, someone wanted to know, to meditation? Is that a form of either hypnosis? And is there such a thing as auto-hypnosis? Can you hypnotize
yourself? So for many, many years, Certainly when I was a student, it was common to say for the professors and for the lecturers to say, any kind of hypnosis is auto-hypnosis, any kind of hypnosis is self-hypnosis. And in many ways, I understand why they taught us these things, because at the end of the day, when you're hypnotized, when you're going through hypnosis, you need to allow this to happen to you. You need to, if you don't want this, you just cover your ears, or you run away, and nobody can touch you, because you understand, I cannot hypnotize somebody against their will. Of course, if I, tie them to a chair and do all kinds of weird things, I can sort of, but usually we don't do that. So in that regard, it's sort of auto-hypnosis. But there are ways to hypnotize people. There are ways to hypnotize people that are not self-hypnosis. It is possible to influence people in a slightly more dramatic way. Usually that would require a lot more exposure. So to do something like that, you can't usually do it in a short session. For that, you need to be in a regular contact with that person. It becomes sort of, you can have a hypnotic relationship. You can be in a situation where you have a hypnotic relationship with somebody with knowledge of hypnotic techniques, can actually sort of slowly, gradually take control over somebody else and influence them hypnotically. That can happen, but that cannot happen in a short period. It needs to be like a protracted relationship. So in that regard, not all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. As for the question about meditation and hypnosis share many common things, but they're actually quite separate. There's some interesting tangential elements and points of contact, but they're actually quite different. I'm actually writing a whole book on this topic with one of my students, but I'll just give you a few examples to show you why they're different. Hypnosis is not a way of life. Meditation is a way of life. People who meditate, they meditate, it's almost like a philosophical outlook on the world. It's like you meditate for compassion, you meditate for peace, you meditate for inner inner peace, high-minded goals. Hypnosis is more of an acute intervention. Hypnosis is not a way of life. Hypnosis you only invoke when you need something specifically for a particular thing. It's not something that you do twice a day, like brushing your teeth. Meditation, on the other hand, is something that you sort of incorporate, like your diet. You incorporate it into your daily life. It's almost like a philosophical outlook. So if I start detailing these things to you, you will see that they're actually quite different. But hypnosis and meditation, in many ways, they sort of share some of the self-regulatory flavor that is top-down. In that regard, they're similar.
So let's shift a little bit, and there's a wonderful question here. Many of them, they're all wonderful. This one says, what can you say about the placebo effect?
So the placebo effect is something that I've actually paid attention to quite a bit, and Dr. Fuchs here also is a person who's done quite a bit and thought quite a bit about this topic, and this is one of the things, for example, that brings some of the scholars together to talk about these things. There's no question, first of all, there's no question that placebo effects are top-down effects. There's no question about that. So in that regard, it's very interesting to study placebo effects because it's a form of a very strong top-down effect. Is it possible that hypnosis, for example, or meditation or other things like that, is it possible that there's a strong placebo effect to them? Is it possible that it's all placebo and so on? These are questions that we're really thinking about, I'm thinking about, people in my group are thinking about long and hard. And we're performing all kinds of experiments, sometimes very fancy, very clever, very complex experiments, in order to test our hypotheses and see what's happening. So far, our answer is, based on everything that we've done over more than almost nearly two decades of research, our answer is it is not all placebo. There's a strong placebo component to what's happening in hypnosis, but there's actually something different that happens when something is a pure placebo, although we're not going to get into what pure placebo is, which is another, what is pure hypnosis, also not entirely clear. But there's definitely a very interesting relationship between placebo effects and hypnosis in the sense that they're both very strong top-down effects. A lot of times, people who are responsive to placebo effects are not responsive to hypnosis effects and vice versa. So to be highly suggestible and highly hypnotizable doesn't necessarily mean that you are a good placebo responder. So by saying this, I'm already showing you that there's some difference, but there's also some overlap between them.
So a related question to that is as follows. If we can measure pain, or imagine pain, sorry, does that mean it's possible to hypnotize ourselves to not feel pain?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a giant here at McGill His name is Ron Malzac. His office is actually still in the building next to us, who basically demonstrated years before I was born, he was able to demonstrate that there's a very strong component to pain, and that is psychological pain. We often feel pain psychologically just as much as we feel it physically, chemically, physiologically. Psychological pain is a very strong component of pain. What we have been able to demonstrate, and particularly what I showed you in this lecture, for example, is that, for example, we are able to distinguish between imagined sensations and hallucinated sensations. They're not the same. If you're trying to imagine something or if you're hallucinating something, it's not the same. That's the first distinction. And the second distinction is that we can make you hallucinate that you don't have pain. We can make you hallucinate that your arm is actually feeling soother and calmer, and that, you know, that you're not having a particular harsh reaction, or you're not anxious, or and so on. And by doing these kind of things, we're actually able to down-regulate the physiology. So the answer is yes, with a big exclamation point.
So we always tell the audience that they should not ask personal questions like, you know, if I have a pain or something like that. But sometimes we get questions that are personal about the speaker. Mm-hmm. And they're optional. Mm-hmm. In other words, you don't have to answer them. So the first one is, have you ever been subject to hypnosis yourself?
So this is a very good question in the sense that, how do you train for hypnosis? You know, how do you train? Like, what does the training involve? Well, lo and behold, the first thing that you do when you're going through hypnosis training is that they split you into pairs, and you hypnotize this person, and this person hypnotizes you. As it turns out, I'm a very bad subject. I don't get hypnotized very easily, and I'm very, very low on the hypnotizability scale. I wish I were higher, but I'm not. But the partner that I had for several years for these kind of study sessions, we switch often, but usually there's a preferred partner just because, you know, there's an issue of trust, there's an issue of all kinds of dynamic, and also very personal things come up, so there's, you know, you want somebody that you can actually trust. The person that I was working with was extremely hypnotizable, and the kind of things that I was able to see, you know, with these things were absolutely remarkable, and the nice thing was that this person was also able to monitor himself. So he was trying to hypnotize me, he got nothing, and I was really disappointed, and he was disappointed. But every time I would hypnotize him, all kinds of things would happen, and I would witness it, but he would also witness it as was happening to him. So he was able to be hypnotized and at the same time monitor his experience, which was absolutely fascinating. And this is something that actually hypnosis allows you to do.
The second personal question is, someone wants to know where you got your tie.
My tie?
Now.
Let me see. I can tell you exactly. It's a company called Golf, G-O-L-F, and...
You're not allowed to advertise.
I think that's it. I'm not responsible for it exactly, but I got it as a gift. Oh, I can give you the name of the person who gave it to me.
The same person is interested in physics. May have something to do with the tie. Mm-hmm. Is there any validity behind the theory of human consciousness being entangled in a quantum field? Are those Higgs bosons on your tie?
First of all, I want to say that the question about the tie was easier to answer than the second question. Okay, now, I'm not sure I even know what that theory is. And when it comes to theories that involve consciousness and quantum mechanics, I have a good suggestion for you. Take it easy. Take it easy. And then we can talk about why we should take it easy. We can talk about that after we take it easy. But in general, there's enough that we don't know about consciousness, and there's enough we don't know about quantum mechanics, so when we put them together, sometimes it's a bit sticky.
There's one more personal question, and it stems directly from your lecture. It says, how many women have you hypnotized?
Let's see. I would estimate that I have hypnotized about maybe 3,000 people in my life, and out of them, half would be women. So about 1,500 women and 1,500 men.
Now, one interesting question really deals with kind of the borderline. You know, if someone is under hypnosis for a long time, or repetitively perhaps, with these suggestions that you're talking about that are planted, Does this become their reality, right? Do they start to believe a new identity as you build it? And what's false and what's true?
These are questions that are not just philosophical, and they're not just, you know, something that I think about when I go to work. These are really questions that haunt me, because I want you to understand, I am basically telling you, not in so many words, but this question is sort of making me paraphrase it in such a way, I'm basically telling you that we live in our heads. I'm basically telling you that the world is relevant, but only partially. It's more relevant what you actually experience in here, because I'm actually able to influence, modulate, regulate, whatever you want to call it, your perceptions. And we learn about the world through our perceptions, through our sensations. And I'm basically telling you that with a top-down effect such as hypnosis, I can actually modulate your sensory information. I can actually create a situation that you actually have a different perception of reality, a different perception of the world. And the answer is, that's right. And the second I do that, I basically change the world in which you live. Without changing the world, I basically change the representation of the world in your head. So yes, there is a little bit of a religious kind of element to it all. But again, I try to take it easy. And I try to think about it through the lens of, you know, a scientist who's doing these experiments with... My philosophy is under-promise and over-deliver. So I try not to sort of overpromise on, you know, what I'm doing here. But as you can see from the question, this is very powerful stuff. This is very interesting stuff. Absolutely.
I mean, is it so powerful, someone asks, that you can not only erase the number 4, but kind of erase the hard disk?
You know, there are several examples in the history of humanity of, if you'd like, I can give you sources about these things, but there are definitely a number of occasions where people have been hypnotized to do really weird things. This is not in our time, because now it's a lot more regulated, and nobody would even think about doing it now, and I think there would be, like, very harsh legal punishments, and it would be, you know, done in a very different way. But there have been experiences where people have been hypnotized to do all kinds of gory things, not for entertainment, but for research purposes. And this is in the days of yore. And sometimes it was shocking to see what, you know, the kind of things that you can push people to do with these kind of things. But we would like to think, just like we take, you know, experiments that are performed in the cellars of certain unscrupulous individuals or Nazi Germany or you know, things like that. There's certain things that we try not to repeat, and we try not to take it too seriously. There's no question that there have been abuses of hypnosis that suggest that it can be used in a very dark way. There's no question about that. But that is also true for medicine. You can do the same. You can come in for, you know, an operation that is meant to remove a uterine cyst, and somebody takes your kidney away. You know, this is also possible. In the world of normal, you know, educated hypnotists, it doesn't occur. It doesn't happen. In the hands of a very vicious, dark person, very bad things can happen.
I'm going to read this question, not because you have to answer it, because it's kind of tangential, but I'm very impressed that someone in the room wrote the question, and I'm quite serious. It says, do you believe in Turner and Grimes' theories on liminality, and you consider hypnosis a rite of passage? The fact that someone in the room is reading Victor Turner on liminality impresses me enormously, and I hope you come back, and I hope you bring many friends back. So I don't think that Turner's notion of liminality is related to hypnosis, but you can comment.
Hypnosis in many ways, in many, many ways, is a ritual. And in our society, just like in any other kind of culture, there are rituals. A ritual can be an initiation into adulthood. It could be, you know, in certain cultures it would be a bar mitzvah. In other cultures it would be something else. At the end of the day, we are going through rituals. These rituals sometimes put us in a very specific mental states. Not just us, but also the people around us, our parents, our siblings, and so on. There is an element, because it's such a strong ritual, there is an element of a rite or initiation rite or rite of passage in these things. But it's not necessarily that every hypnotic experience is an initiation rite or a rite of passage. But it's probably, the other way is probably true. Every rite of passage is probably some kind of a ritual that involves hypnotic elements, or likely involve hypnotic elements. But there is some kind of an interesting relationship there.
So every bar mitzvah is a little hypnosis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly every bar mitzvah is a rite of passage and a liminal event. But that's another discussion. Maybe we'll pick that up next year. Now, many people have asked for a demonstration of hypnosis, which we're not going to do.
No, that would be unethical, yeah.
And we it's not appropriate to handle that kind of lightly in the carnival atmosphere. On the other hand, somebody asked, can you do a magic trick, please?
Sure.
And first of all, I think Dr. Raz has already done a magic trick tonight with his wonderful lecture. So let's give him a round of applause just for that.
Thank you.
And before, I want to give him the last word or the last trick, but before he does that, A, thank you for being here and for paying attention and for your really wonderful questions. B, make sure you come back for Sean Clark's lecture. Dr. Clark is a professor in the School of Nursing, and we'll talk about what that discipline is all about, how nurses are members of the healthcare team. Remember, sign up for the Neuro Tours. I said there were lectures. They're not lectures. You have enough lectures all day and at night. The Neuro Art Tours, where you can see some of the equipment that Dr. Raz uses for his research. So before I tell you to have a safe journey home, we're always going to finish on time at 8 o'clock, and we always start on time at 6:30, and Dr. Raz has...
All right, so I need a volunteer. You? Let's have a volunteer, and I'll show you a,
Pick
a quick
card. And, it's not that. Eh?
it's not because I want everybody to see. Come down. Whoever wants to participate, come. One person, come down. There you go.
This won't be hypnosis, right?
No hypnosis. Have a seat. What's your name?
Sandra.
Hi, Sandra. Nice to meet you. Okay, so I'm going to show you a trick that everybody can see but Sandra, okay, because you're many and there's only one, so I'll try to do it to Sandra in such a way that you can see, but that she can't see. Fair? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so I happen to have with me sponge balls. Okay, every good magician always walks around with some sponge balls in their pockets. You can look at them. You want to let go of your phone for just a second? It's difficult, but you know, okay? So sponge balls, good? Okay, and as it so happens, I have two more. Okay, so your job is to guard my balls. Can you do that? So close this hand, and guard my balls, okay? And my job is to guard these two. And now I'm going to show you what I'm going to do. She's not going to see. Now I want you to see what I'm doing and keep quiet, because if you're going to giggle... Of course, I want you to, but if you're going to giggle at an opportune time, she's going to tell what's going on. So don't. Keep a very poker face, okay? Are you keeping my balls? It's going to be very easy with her, I can see already. But okay, two balls. Can you see the balls? Two balls, and keep quiet because I'm doing it for you, okay? So, two balls, and your job... Do you have contact lenses?
Yeah.
Okay, I can see that. What's your prescription, more or less? Do you know?
Three.
Good. Okay. So, your job is to tell me how many balls I have in each hand, okay? And don't let me reach into these balls, okay? Ready? One, two, three. How many balls do I have in each hand? Where? Okay, two here. Okay, very good. So far, so good. I'm going to try to do it again, okay? And you tell me how many balls I have in each hand. Okay, how about now? What's the situation right now? 1-1, very good. Okay, now we're going to start betting money on it, okay? Fair or not? Fair? Okay, so 1-2, what's the situation? And how many here?
Zero.
That's right, so 0 and no, none. Okay, so you lost one. I have to. I'm sorry, I'm out. So try not to lose this one, okay? Okay, So I want you to tell me where the ball is going. Don't tell her. Okay? I want you to tell me where the ball is going. Fair? Very easy. Okay, so what's the situation right now? Very good. You see? Just trust yourself. Okay, just on one, two, you know, I always do like the same movement and, you know, it disappears. Fair? Ready? Okay, so what's the situation now? No. Almost. Okay? But it's okay. We'll do it again until you get it. Okay? Until you get it. Ready? So we do this. Just think about it. One and none. It's inside this one. Okay, so just... yeah? You want to check here? No. Let me try. You lost another one, so let's try again. Okay, now you're really going to concentrate, okay? Now you're really going to concentrate, okay? I'm going to do it really slowly, like really slowly. I'm going to... Very good. So you see, you need to trust yourself. Fair? Always at the same time. Always at the same time. Ready? Ready? One, two. I'm always doing it at the same time. Okay, one, two, and real fast.
One.
Yeah. Okay, you got this one right. You got this one right, but this one is wrong, actually. What? Okay, we'll do it with one, okay? We'll do it with one, because you're no more balls. You did not guard my balls well. Okay, let's try on the last one. Ready? Ready? Last one. Do you see what I'm doing? Notice, remember how I told you about stuff that you can see but you're not registering? She's actually not registering. But there's a lot of pressure on her. There's a lot of pressure. She's performing. She's performing. Ready? Last one. No pressure. Okay, so usually what I do is I do something like this, right? So what's the situation? Where's the one? Okay, let's try again, okay? Slowly, no pressure, slowly. I usually do this, and then it disappears, right? Where is it? Are you sure? You should be. You should be. It's easy, right? So we're going to do it one more time. I'm showing you what I'm doing. All the time I'm showing you what I'm doing, okay? Putting it here, and... So now you have to tell me, because you've seen it, let me think, one, two, three, four, maybe more times. What's your theory? There's a theory here, right? Where is it? Could you see that I'm every time I'm reaching? Could you see that every time I'm, could you see it like every single time that I'm reaching in, or no? No. So how did it happen? No idea? Do you see how powerful this is? But... if you look behind you, maybe it's going to help. Thank you very much.
Amir, thank you.
Thanks, Sandra.
And thank your assistant.
Thank you, Sandra.
That was great. Thank you very much. We'll see you all next week. Safe travel home. That was great.
All right, sir.
Thank you.
Good. This is yours. This is yours.